Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. I'm fresh back from a bit of a tour of the Southwest. I flew into Los Angeles to interview a man in jail for a legal case. And then I flew on to Tucson, where I gave a talk and then a workshop at Howie Glasser's Nurtured Heart Approach. Howie has developed a lovely way of helping kids, emphasizing not their problems, but how to bring out their greatness. Howie is he's just doing wonderful things all around the world. He's applying it in schools. He's got trainers developing all over the world. And the people who come to his conference are among the most marvelous in the world. One of the things Howie does that very few people who are trying to develop and sell an approach do is he's so ethical that he has always made it a point to stand up to the psychiatric establishment and say you can't drug kids. And we're going to have a guest on today whose mentor and himself has done something of the same. Before getting to him, we're going to have a really interesting and good guest reprising a much, much earlier session we did together. My book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, is supposed to arrive now, multiple cartons at the office in the next couple of days. The new printing has been made. We're waiting for them to arrive. And then it will go out with the wonderful bonus of the antidepressant fact book. So you literally get two books for the price of one. You'll get Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety and the antidepressant fact book. It's been such a disappointment to us that, well, glad the first printing sold out, but a disappointment that Christmas and New Year's stopped the second and third printing from getting here. They scrounged around, found a carton of books, and sent it to Howie's conference in Tucson, and it sold out there. So I'm really, this is a book that people seem to be really benefiting from, and I have high hopes for it. And I hope you'll have a look at it either on my website, of course it's Bregan.com, or on Amazon, where you can get it overnight right now, but you'll have to still wait a few days. We still have not gotten our cartons from the second and third printing. We expect them to arrive this weekend to go out within 1 to 2 days. My assistant, Missy, will just work overtime to get it to you. Now, my guest today, Bob, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good, good, good. My guest is Robert Wubelding. Am I pronouncing that right, Bob?
Yes,
or did I forget?
That's good. Yeah, very good.
Robert E. Wubelding. And you can find him on the net. And his name is spelled, last name is spelled, and it's E-D, E-D-D.
Yes.
And his name is spelled W-U-B-B-O-L-D-I-N-G, Wub with a W-U-B and then Bulding, Wubelding. And he's a teacher, he's an author. He's familiar to me as a practitioner of reality therapy. Bill Glasser, moving from Howie Glasser to Bill Glasser, he's an advocate in a sensible and his own way of Bill Glasser's reality therapy. Bill has influenced me, and he's gone now, and I suspect I influenced Bill. And we have presented together. He's presented at my conferences. I presented at his. Bill was an amazing man who, before I did, because he's older, said no to psychiatric drugs and yes to psychotherapy, put a huge emphasis on decision-making, responsibility, which he called reality, facing reality, I think. We'll let Bob elaborate on that. And Bob and I had a very good show. It's just a pleasure talking to somebody who cares about people, thinks about people, has been a therapist. I like to have just good, solid, therapeutically oriented people on the show. And so I welcome you back, Bob.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's good to be back. I was on the show in the fall after William Glasser died. And I appreciate the opportunity you gave me to pay tribute to him and to his work. His life work is called Reality Therapy. And by the way, I attended Howie Glasser's session one time when he was here in Cincinnati. And I thought it was very good. But he's no relation to Bill Glasser that I know of. And
no.
But they do have the same last name. So, but they were both excellent, excellent men and very skilled at what they were doing. I'd like to begin just a little comment, Peter, if it's okay, a quote from a book, and I will tell you the name of the book after I read the quote, if that's okay. It's a short sentence.
Sure.
It says here, when you learn to consciously choose the direction of your life based on sound principles, you will be surprised to learn how many opportunities are available to you. That is on page 209 of a book that I think every student in college should be reading, every graduate student, and it's called Wow, I'm an American, How to Live Like Our Nation's Heroic Founders, and the author is Peter Bregan. So I think I would just want to thank you for writing that book, and I love that quote, when you learn to consciously choose. When you learn means we don't instinctively consciously choose. We have to learn choices and then choose the overall direction. Where are we headed in our lives based on sound principles? I hear this phrase occasionally, follow your dream. Well, I qualify that by saying follow your dream if there's a market for it. If you major in 17th century Albanian folk dancing, you're probably not going to be able to make much of a living at that. It might be a nice thing to do, but it's tough to make a living at that kind of thing. So sound principles mean can you market, not in a crass kind of way, but can you truly, will your direction, in other words, truly satisfy you? And then you said you'd be surprised. I love that. You'd be surprised how many opportunities are available to you. So that's just something that I read this book occasionally, and I just love it because it's so positive, so upbeat, and so rooted in the grand traditions of our country and of freedom. So that's just a thought.
Well, I'm delighted. I don't often talk about that book. Because it does take a very specific viewpoint on America.
Yeah.
I don't expect all of my listeners to share, but I sure wish they would, and or the potential of America and what principles it was founded on. So thank you for bringing it up. That was unexpected. Just thanks for bringing that up. And where do you want to go now, unexpectedly, with this show?
Well, I read what you've written recently about understanding and helping people with the negative legacy emotions, and you explained how they are the result of our evolution and our early childhood, and then you lead into the fact of making some other choices. And I'd like to relate that to a famous quote of Ashley Montague, who said, heredity is not destiny. And we need to deal with our heredity and with our background and our trauma, which, of course, we're seeing more and more of with soldiers coming home, and our society is becoming more conscious of many different types of trauma that people have suffered. And at the same time, when we do reality therapy, we listen for that empathically, as you stress, and we don't fault people for it or criticize them or anything like that, or or God forbid, you have a sentence in there where some therapist would say, well, what did you do to bring this on, your shame and your guilt? To me, as you said, that does, I mean, it's not very helpful. And so what a reality therapist would do would be to after exploring and allowing the person to explore all their events of their past, recent or not so recent, we would say, well, what are your choices now, and what can you do at this moment, and especially in the area of relationships, how can you get close to some people around you? So I think those are well, when, and you know, in reality therapy, we stress the relationships. There's plenty of evidence that suggests that makes life a lot better when you have enjoyable relationships.
What Bob is referring to is when I realized he was coming on the show, and I didn't have him a guilt, shame, and anxiety book to send, since we have like two in the office, I think. I sent him the galley, the printed pages of an article that's coming out in the next edition of the Humanistic Psychologist, not the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, which it gets confused with, but the Humanistic Psychologist, which is actually the Humanistic Psychology APA journal. And in it, it's an article about hallucinations, but it applies the theory of negative legacy emotions. So it summarizes the heart of the book and the theory that guilt, shame, and anxiety are inherited. Literally, they are natural selections process for anger management, so that a being as angry and violent as us and yet as loving of us inherits this buffer of guilt, shame, and anxiety that rises up when we get ready to unleash our willfulness and anger on our intimate relationships. And this is the theory of negative legacy emotions built on biology of evolution, but also on the function then in society, and particularly in childhood, how we develop these emotions to control us, but how they don't really help when we grow up and need to make positive, loving, creative choices free of guilt, shame, and anxiety. That's a nubbin of the theory of negative legacy emotions that's in my book. Thank you for bringing that up,
too.
Oh,
yeah, it's an excellent article. In fact, I'm writing about three books right now and revising chapters in textbooks. I have about 25 chapters in various kinds of counseling textbooks, and I'm going to reference your work a little bit more here, and always have, but I want to quote the most recent article and the book when I get it in these chapters, because it fits so nicely with good, solid psychotherapy, and I think people need to know about it who read the textbooks. So,
Bob, what is happening to the legacy of Bill Glasser? It's interesting to me, because as I get older, I wonder what will happen to my legacy, and I suspect it will be limited to 1,001 videos, books, and articles, and not to an organization. Because that hasn't been what I have found. I don't see people coming along like you and particularly doing what I do, in part because it's so dangerous.
Well,
what's happening to Bill Glasser's legacy, and where are you fitting into that?
Well, I write about his work and the extensions of it that I've made and the adaptations to various issues. I write about that more than anybody does, and so I'm doing my best to carry it on, and I consult with Carlene, his wife, and there is an institute, an international institute, with branches in various countries, and what they primarily do, they're in the early stages of forming. They've been in existence a couple of years now, and they're coming up with policies and so on for training people in the choice theory, which is the theoretical basis of reality therapy, and then in the delivery system itself, reality therapy. But I can honestly say that my 13 books, soon to be 14, 15, they are an attempt to continue this and to contribute to the psychological counseling psychotherapy literature that people can use. And a couple of my books are used in various countries, and they're translated. I'm working on a translation in Japanese. In fact, I'll be there in August to promote the book. And I think his legacy will continue. But you know how it is when the founder and the person regarded as the most influential of any theory, when they pass from the scene, the ideas tend to dissipate a little bit. And not always, of course. The psychoanalytic school will always flourish, I suppose, as well as cognitive. And some of us are doing everything we can to continue this, the Institute on an organizational basis, and myself on a writing basis. So I try to make sure reality therapy is represented in all the textbooks, and I think that's one way it will survive and it will flourish, if it is represented to the students who study counseling and are the current and future therapists in our great land and throughout the world.
Do you have a book in particular that you're involved with that you'd recommend to folks at this point?
Well, I think my two major books at this point, one was called Reality Therapy for the 21st Century. I will be revising that. It was published in the year 2000, and it is the most comprehensive book. It took me 7 years to write it, and it's the most comprehensive book, and also a shorter book published by the American Psychological Association. It's called Reality Therapy, Theories of Psychotherapy. I kind of tell a joke about it. I say it's a million seller. I got a million of them in my cellar.
Ah, what's Bill's best book for folks to read?
I would say his book, Choice Theory.
That's like one of his last.
Yes, that's the seminal book. It's not his last, but
it's near to the end, isn't it?
It was written in 1998, mm-hmm. and then Carlene revised one of his, and it's called Take Effective Control of Your Life, and that came out just a few years ago. Well, it came out in 2011, and then his book is very controversial is called Warning: Psychiatry Can Be Hazardous to Your Mental Health. And he talks in there about psychiatric drugs, and it's a controversial book, but he takes a stand on that, and you have to like you.
When did he first write that?
That was written. I have it in front of me here. It written in 2005. I quote it all the time, but I quote so many of them, I forget exact dates. This was. Wait a minute. 2003.
Yeah.
Earlier than I thought. Okay. So I think he quotes you at length in here. And there's a foreword by Terry Lynch, who's an Irish physician. You may know him.
I do. Terry's on our board, as is.
Oh, is he? Yeah.
As was Bill.
Yeah.
That when I saw our board, that's the Empathic Therapy Center. Empathictherapy.org. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about therapy and, what is the essence of it? What is it all about? Why do we have it? Does it make any sense at all? I think it would be fun to unleash you on some of these larger issues.
Well, I think really what it's about is it comes down to one word, relationship. In fact, I just attended a conference, the Brief Therapy Conference in December out in Anaheim. I go to that every year. I'm usually on the program. And so there's a well-known researcher named Scott Miller. And Scott, he researches articles and on the effectiveness of counseling and psychotherapy. And he verifies what I believe we have known for many years, and that is that it doesn't matter what degree you have. Not that degrees are unimportant. No one would say that. But it's the relationship more than anything that really brings about the result. So when we, for example, teach reality therapy, I usually say, I think what we're teaching is relationships here, but we're teaching a method of how to form a relationship and how to demonstrate empathy and how to explore what people want and help them evaluate what they're doing. I've tried to summarize that with four letters, WDEP, which stands for wants, doing, evaluation, and planning. But really, these are tools for connecting with people. And they're not an end in themselves, but that seems to be what therapy and counseling is all about, that you try to enter that person's world and see it as they see it, but also see not only where they are, but see where they can be. And that's why I like that quote that I mentioned. You'll be surprised to learn how many opportunities are available to you. And people learn that in counseling. They learn about opportunities and choices that they have that they did not have. And so it seems to me that's the essence of the whole thing. The Carl Rogers showed this in 1957 in the famous article. It was called The Necessary and Sufficient Conditions for Change. He called it personality change. And he said his research and as well as his experience demonstrated the importance of the relationship. He said it was necessary and sufficient, which was really quite a statement in those days. And maybe I think it's still relevant, don't you?
Yes. Everywhere I go, I emphasize relationship. It still confuses me, and I mean that genuinely, the difference between the relationship I have with a client and the content of the discussion, which takes various turns depending on my client and on my current emphasis in therapy, which probably has changed somewhat over the years, you know, whether I'm thinking more about the importance of abuse issues or more about the importance of choice and so on. But it is interesting that all of us, I'm sure you are too, are really devoted to some sense of we have an understanding of life and we're working from that basis and we're helping people understand usually some of their childhood self-defeating approaches and helping them correct them.
Sure.
But that underlying it somehow, and more important even, is relationship. And so I still puzzle over how to reconcile that I have so many rational ideas about life and how to live it and the importance of childhood and overcoming guilt, shame, and anxiety. But on the other hand, I know that relationship is the most healing thing there is. So it's, to me, there's still a confusion as I progress along doing therapy.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that so clearly in our current society that everything focuses on that, whether it's fundraising or whether it's buying a car. You buy a car from a salesperson you kind of like. And now some people don't, but I mean, it makes a difference if that salesperson is rude and so on. People don't go back. And even if some people don't even go back to a store, even if they can get a better deal, because they were treated rudely in the past. So it's we connect with people, and that leads to some action subsequently to that connection or part of the relationship. It's just across the board, and I was on a tour one time, and I never forget this. I was sitting on the plane next to the tour guide, and I asked the tour guide, I said, what really makes for a good tour from your point of view? And he says, well, if I can get involved with the tourists, if I could kind of relate to them and they trust me, he says, they'll see things and do things that they never would have done before. This is a tour guide.
Yeah.
So
I do. Go ahead.
It really, it just impressed me and reinforced something that I, and in our business, something that we really know and can verify with our experience.
How much emphasis in a normal, you spend about an hour with folks like most of us do, or?
Oh, yeah, sure. Most of the time, not always, but that's, you know, what you aim for, and maybe a little less than that, but it's not.
How much of your time do you think is actually focused on emphasizing these basic concepts from Bill of personal responsibility and choice?
How much of my time? You
yeah.
mean in counseling itself?
Yeah.
Oh, I think the majority of it is. Without being, you know, rigid or puristic in the application of the principles, I don't do that. But I think a lot of my time is spent listening, and just listen very carefully. I listen for two things. I listen for in control behavior, where they express that they have had some control in their lives, and I listen for any choices that they are making or had made, and then to try to build on that. And I also listen for metaphors that they use, because this is, I think, a way to demonstrate empathy. A person said to me one time, "I draw a yellow chalk line around me, and I don't let anybody in." I thought, oh, my goodness, what a marvelous statement to respond to instead of paraphrasing it. But, you know, to try to get inside that statement and what does that mean to him is it took a lot of work, and we talked about it and went on in some detail about it. And my question is often very surprising to the client. I said, well, you know, it's a chalk line. It's not a brick wall. And I said, you can move a chalk line back and forth. Would you be interested in that? Would you be interested in erasing part of it for a while? You can always draw it back. And see, what you're talking about to me when you do that is there's a subliminal message that comes across to the person. And that is, I can have a better life. I can make a change, and I'm going to be surprised at the many opportunities available to me, as you said on page 209 in your book. And it's a very powerful way to help people deal with their frustrations and their upsetness. And I think the best thing that people gain from therapy is an indirect, subtle, as I say, I don't know if the correct word is subliminal, but they get something that you might not have even talked about. They gain something that you didn't explicitly talk about. And in your article, for example, Peter, you talk about this woman.
Well, Bob,
who had...
I'm gonna. Bob, let me interrupt.
Sure.
Because you made a transition, and it's 4:30. We can go to the music. My guest is Bob Wubbolding, Wubbolding. He's a therapist, psychologist, and a man who has a lot of wisdom. And we'll come back and we can talk some about that article of mine that's coming out. And just about, you know, let's just look at life some together.
Sure.
Okay. Let's go to break. Hold a conference every week, and I have a nice large conference audience live. And then we have all those wonderful people downloading over the years, building into the many tens of thousands and getting around 100,000, I think, now.
Oh.
And Bob Wobbleding is my guest. We were chatting during the break. And pick up on where you wanted to go.
Okay, I was going to mention a case or a situation that you describe in your article about a woman who she had a problem with visualizing things. She could visualize really so effectively that it got in her way, and it was a problem for her. And it says here that it interfered with her driving. She at times had to pull her car over to the side of the road because it interfered with her driving, and it could be quite dangerous. And what you did is you turned that around and helped her use that instead of overcoming it, instead of banishing that phenomenon from her consciousness. You helped her use it, and she ended up buying a television camera and making some movies, and she was very good at visualizing, and she turned it around and used it in a positive way. And I thought that was a very good example of a skill, and it's a listening skill. It's an empathic skill to take what the person says and kind of see it in a different light, not to deny it, not to criticize it or put it down, but to give it a different meaning. It's like reframing a picture. The picture looks different. It's the same picture, but if you change the frame, people say, is that a new picture? And in many ways it is, because it has a reframe. It has a different border. And I think that's an example of that, and it is it takes skill to really to really recognize when to do that and how to do that, but not just as a technique, as a blindly applied technique, but rather as a result of hearing that person and actually seeing it as a positive. It can't be phony. It can't be just backslapping rah-rah. It has to be genuine. And that was, I think that's a beautiful example of that paradoxical technique of taking a negative and twisting it around and making it a positive. And so I think that's a way to, you know, to me it's an advanced level of empathy.
Well, I think it's so much in life. It's our actual unique qualities or our special abilities that get us into trouble often, because they're there, and for other people they're threatening in some way. And we need to figure out what to do with the music in our heads. Or the voices that we hear, or the visions that we have, or the imaginations we have, or the dreams we have. So often, the people who come to me, especially if they're really disturbed people that somebody else would like to hospitalize and drug and give a nasty label to, like schizophrenia or schizoaffective or bipolar or something, incredibly creative people, incredibly sensitive people who don't trust their power, don't trust their energy, and end up, in a sense, squandering or distorting it.
Yeah.
And I want to help them get back to appreciate their power and the qualities that they struggle with that are so positive that they may be seeing as liabilities, you know? And including the whole thing about feeling. How many people come to therapists and say, I'm feeling too much?
Yeah.
It's not that you're feeling too much. It's that you're dominated by your painful feelings. What would it be like to be running with love instead of a constant chatter attacking you inside your head?
I used to work at a halfway house for women ex-offenders. And these were pretty tough customers, I'll tell you. and most of them were in there for drugs and you know, passing bad checks and so on. And I'll never forget a woman who had gotten fired from like 10 jobs. She could last about a month, and then she got fired because she would tell off the supervisor in no uncertain terms. And you tend to think of that as negative and see, but I think what we did was, one night in the group, I said, you know something? You have a very unique skill of finding a job. And she kind of was taken back by that. What do you mean? I said, you have found 8 or however many jobs it was in the last year. Now, it's true you get fired from them after about a month or 6 weeks, but you have a lot of energy and you have a determination. That's pretty evident to anyone who listens to you. And so you can find a job, but now what do you think about this? Are you, if you got another job, would you be able to keep it instead of getting fired in 5 weeks? Could you keep it for 6 weeks? Get fired after that. Just keep it for a little bit longer. So we're trying to take the pain out of what she does. And the paradox is, when the time comes to get fired, they say, "Oh well, I don't want to bother with that. I'll just hold on to this job." You know, that's the control. That's the choice a person has. And they start to see that they do have choices. And so, that, again, that's a kind of a reframing of what many people would see as a negative, getting fired. My gosh, Al, what'd you do to get fired? What'd you do to bring that on? Well, that blame doesn't help much. But turn that around and make it a positive.
I'm with you 100%, and I don't do it as much as I should, you know? I mean, it's so easy to get caught up in looking at the negative. And as I think about someone like that woman, my God, what a skill it is to impress 8 different hiring groups in a year when you've got such a checkered past. So what is that power you have to so impress other human beings with your abilities? And what's the essence of that? How can you harness that? Because, my gosh, if you could harness that capacity to win people over into something really constructive, what a life you could have.
Oh, yeah. So, and then people, you know, you can watch their nonverbal when you do that. You watch the Rudolf Dreiker says, look for the glint in their eye. I love that. He's a famous Adlerian, and I don't know what a glint is, but I think it's a kind of a sparkle. Their eyes light up, their eyebrows are elevated, and you see that little smile around their mouth. Maybe a change in the posture, because they start to say, this guy believes in me. And believes in my energy, believes in my power that's perhaps untapped, unused. But he thinks there's something there, so maybe there is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of things get distorted because in childhood, we can't really have the confidence of an adult. And it's very hard as children to look at what it is we really have that's special and unique.
Yeah.
And to begin developing it at an early age. You know, I look back at my childhood, I had this incredible sense of injustice and writing injustice and wanting to do what was right. But I had no sense that was actually could be this huge thing to bring to the world. To me, it was more of a complaint about the world. I had to get straight over time to stop complaining about the world and to see with clarity that if that was my vision, that was my vision. It wasn't going to be everybody else's. Too many people are focused on overcoming injustice, but that I could do that. I could do that. And we all have such different things we want to do.
Yeah. Well, you certainly have channeled it.
I think.
And I hope someone in the future, a long time from now, continues your legacy because you have taken principled and courageous stands that have not always been very popular, but which are based on research and data. And I've seen you on TV appearing before Congress and congressional committees and so on. That's the level you've reached, and I can only hope and pray that people listen.
I can tell you that 30 years ago, at about the time I got together with Ginger, my wife, I was so discouraged about even getting anything more published.
Yeah.
That I thought it was a huge deal when a university asked if I would like to give my papers to their humanistic psychology papers archives they were setting up. I don't even remember the university now, because the only papers I have that I care about I published.
But that
seemed like, oh my gosh, at least 100 years or now, all these unpublished manuscripts will be in an archive somewhere. And now, of course, I got the more than 20 books published. I had a few then, but I do think that I really like what you selected out of my book, Wow, I'm an American, this idea that if we pursue principle and we just pursue principle, we keep doing it. And in addition, find a loving way of communicating it, that we will have success and opportunity beyond anything that we ever expected.
I think that's right. And in a way, it's easier, too. It's easier because you don't have to try to remember lies. I mean, that's hard to do if you start lying and start fudging on things. How do you remember what you did and didn't do? And so,
yes, how do you even remember who you are? I think once a person starts tailoring who they are to circumstance, it's hard to remember who you are. You forget who you are. I've never put it that way before. I think that's a real, real part of what happens to most folks.
Well, I think yours will endure, and I think you do have enough influence to make that happen.
I was surprised when I started talking with him how much he too also believed in love and relationship, not just choice and responsibility. And you started to talk about that. He seems to have really believed in love.
I think so. In fact, we talk about five needs: survival, belonging, power, freedom, and fun in the reality therapy. And he's always stressed, and more towards the end of his life, he even stressed it more than prior to that time, many problems. The way he put it is most long-term psychological problems are relationship problems. Now, I kind of temper that a little bit by saying at least there is a relationship aspect to them, and that's a good place to start when you counsel with people. If you don't know what to do, talk about their relationship, and especially beginning therapists, they say, where do I start? And I'd say, well, that's a good place to start. Because if you look at the DSM-5, you can't find a problem in there that doesn't have some relationship attached to it.
Right.
You know, all these labels that we give people, attention deficit disorder and conduct disorder, everything, are there relationship aspects to those? Of course there are. And all of these things have an underlying or at least a concomitant dysfunction in their interpersonal relationships. And so we can talk about that.
I like to think about it is I haven't used these terms in a while, but some of my early papers, and I think it's still worth thinking about, is that our job as therapists is to build a little utopia.
Yeah.
A utopian setting. Our job is to provide the person who comes to us a setting that is protected, safe, respectful, caring, ethical, and that provides them, therefore, the opportunity to look at themselves and explore their lives and build a new and or better life. But it is utopian. We're able to create something as therapists that if it works, and, you know, it's not always going to work. There are two folks involved, us, at least two, us and the client, maybe a few other people, directly or indirectly. But our job is to really provide a wonderful place to come to be where you as a therapist feel comfortable, where your client feels treasured, cared about, feels that you're interested in them, and that you're willing to have important conversations about their life and what they can do in their life. And that's very utopian. That is achieved in a few good friendships and a few good marriages, and we try to create it with everyone who walks into our offices. And I think that's a really good way to look at it.
And I think we can teach that. We can teach them, maybe indirectly, but teach them, or they can learn that and implement that in their own lives and take the relationship we have with them and transfer that to their interconnections with other people. In reality, therapy, we have a little concept that sounds like a slogan, but it has a technical meaning, quality time. And one of the things we try to encourage people to do, especially couples or parent and child, is to spend some time together alone with that person for a limited amount of time. It doesn't have to be all day or hours, but it should be consistent, where we avoid the ABCs, A, arguing, B, blaming, and C, criticizing. And so it should be just time spent, the idea being to build up a storehouse of memories, a storehouse of positive perceptions toward that other person. And this is especially important when people are not getting along. I've found when people come to counseling and their problems usually surface on the level of they can't compromise or problem solve, or they can't communicate with each other. That's what they say. And I say, well, have you tried communicating? And they always say, yes, yes. And I say, well, how's that worked out for you? Not too well. I said, okay, let's see if we can't work on spending some time together where you don't talk about the heavy problems but you do just kind of talk about trivialities, or you talk about the neighbors, or take a walk and talk about what you observe in nature around you. And what happens is then the other problems become a lot easier to cope with because they have that storehouse of pleasant experiences together. I can still remember time with my father when I was a kid. He died when I was pretty young, but I can remember him taking me up the street for ice cream. He would take me up for an ice cream cone in the evenings. And I can remember that it was very valuable time spent together. And I don't think we talked about anything heavy duty. He didn't criticize me. We just walked, and that really cemented the relationship. And if he'd been around later, I'm sure it would have helped when we had some problems together.
You know, birds and other animals will mate sometimes for life, and whether they mated for life or not, they will do a lot of cooing together. They'll rub their beaks or their cheeks, and they'll groom, and they'll just do all these things. They'll chirp at each other. They do all these things that basically say, I love you, I love you, I love you.
Yeah.
And I really believe in helping. I really believe in my own life that Ginger and I chirping at each other and just, you know, brushing cheeks in effect and just doing that little dance that creatures do to say, I love you, I'm yours, here I am, we're a pair, we're together. I've never actually put it this way before, Bob. I just think that that's a kind of a pure thing that we just need to do with each other. And I find when I travel now that there are people who just want to come and sit with me and chirp with me.
Yeah, yeah.
And about how much we like each other. We chirp. And
I like that.
Chirping. I never thought of it this way before, but it's really true. You know, our Shetland sheepdogs, you know, if one of the dogs is out 5 minutes without the other, when they come back in, one of them comes in, finds the other, it just checks out and sort of rubs a little bit and sniffs a little bit and sort of checks around, often around the face, not just the rear end.
Yeah.
See, what's going on? How you been? I've been gone 5 or 10 minutes. I'm here. I'm back. Here we are. I just want to help. I want to help people more and more get to that essence of folks loving each other, and getting to the essence of it. It can be a hug. It can be a little dance. It can be just leaning on each other and watching a romantic movie. Folks, don't be ashamed to want love and to be loving and to find folks who want to chirp with you. How's that?
And I think that's
message.
Part of parenting is this, I call it the 4 ACT, the parent affirming the feelings of the kid, accepting the child as they are, and showing affection, the father especially and the son, showing affection. Conversation can be the WDEP. What do you want? And what are you doing? And how are things going? And is it helping? It doesn't have to be heavy duty. It doesn't have to be criticizing. It can be just kind of chirping and listening and talking.
And don't be afraid, folks, to say, I love you.
Yeah.
You matter to me. God sent you to me. Don't be afraid if you have those feelings to explore them and express them. Love has a sacred quality to me. It doesn't make us isolated. Love really connects us to the universe, because if we love one another, we realize there's such a thing as love and that other people share it and that maybe it has a source, whether it's nature or God, that's a preeminent importance. And
My wife and I have incorporated that the first thing we say to each other in the morning is, I love you, and that's the last thing we say to each other at night. It's very simple, and if you have had a rough day, and it sometimes is takes a real choice to do that. It's not just because you feel like it. Sometimes we say it when we don't necessarily feel it deep inside. We might be a little annoyed, but it's still important because it's a basic sentiment. It's more fundamental than any passing problem.
Yeah, that's well put. Love is more fundamental than any passing problem. And folks, the more you can relate to people on that basis, the more you will enjoy life and people will enjoy you, and the more you'll accomplish and the more you'll get done. And then there'll be a lot of other people who are uncomfortable with that, and they will probably stay away from you and not cause you very much direct aggravation.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
being loving sort of winnows out your relationships with other people. A lot of people are not ready for that, and that'll be okay at that point in time.
Sure.
Well, we're getting down to the very end here. I had no idea what we'd explore today. I like having Bob Woolding on just to explore, you know, what have we been thinking about as therapists all these years? what do we think matters and what do we really care about? I think you've got about half a minute. Do you have some closing thoughts?
Well, I would say my old motto from when I was first in college, I had it in front of me, and I still think it's important, carpe diem. Carpe seize, take, and diem day. Take the day, seize the day, and love somebody with that energy. And I think that's pretty good advice that I read somewhere, and I've tried to follow that advice, which, of course, I fall off the wagon regularly, but it isn't whether you fall off the wagon, it's whether you get back on that counts.
Bob Wobbleding, thank you so much for being on my radio show.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, and God bless you and your audience.
God bless you.